my landlord, I actually caught him snooping and looking in the window when he thought that I was at work, but I had actually just transitioned and started working from home.
So they come in and you're like, oh, you've got such cool hair and you've got such a cool little personality and like jaunty little things, and they'll shout at you when you do anything like, how dare you touch my feet?
I was very close to Belinda. Actually, everyone probably would say that. Everyone had their own little individual relationship with her.
We got Belinda because Mum's a vet, and one of her friends who owned a farm, a cattle farm, had a cow who had sort of rejected its daughter. And so we took Belinda to suburbia with us. And she lived.
Claudia grew up in Bayview in the northern beaches of Sydney, and she was just 7 years old when Belinda the calf joined her family.
We had to use a human belt instead of like a dog collar because none of the dog collars would fit her. She would hang out with the dogs, but she wore a collar that was a human belt around her neck, except at night when we tied her up to the hills hoist. But she could still get far enough to like sit in all the bushes, so she just flattened everything. And because she was a baby when we got her, we had to mix up all of the milk powder. And then you'd get your hand and stick it in her mouth and she'd suck your fingers. And then you'd like lead her head down to the milk bucket and she'd start sucking out of the bucket. It was so cute. She had to sleep in her little shed with all the hay and stuff. She'd mush all the hay up so she'd make a little nest for herself to little snooze in. She'd sit there, we'd both sit there and like in a bush together, and I'd read stories to her. Just little, like I would have been 7 or 8 years old, so it was like little picture books that had fairly basic stories. There was one about a frog that I used to read her quite a lot.
Belinda started a bit of a cow fascination for seven-year-old Claudia, one that's carried on into her 30s.
But I also had a cow collection. That started my cow fandom. I collected like cow figurines, like my whole room was full of cow stuff after Belinda. Like, and I think while we had her was when I started collecting cow things and like started a group. You know, when you're in primary school and you have like a club, like you start a club with your friends. We started one called the Holy Cow, and like, I made a little theme song for it and everything.
Can you remember the theme song?
It goes, the Holy Cow. What cows might fly. I was the president. I was the president
of
the Holy Cow Club. There were like five of us. We had like a secretary and all of that. We all did exactly the same thing though, so it didn't matter. Well, she started off quite small. She started off like calf, like fresh out of the cow calf size. And then she left full-blown Hereford size, just big old cow in a trailer. She left in a trailer. Bye. I remember driving off up the street. It was really sad. I was really sad to see it go.
Fast forward 15 years and Claudia and her partner Nick are camping in a paddock on a friend's farm.
I loved that place because I loved cows, because of Belinda. We went down to camp and to play music to the cows because cows are very curious. And so I was playing the cello and he was playing the guitar, and we were surrounded by a whole group of cows. They kind of came at us really quickly and they ran up. And then we had a cow audience, he proposed to me. Because they were attracted by the music. They love it. They're so curious. And then we ate snake for dinner afterwards. I didn't know he was going to propose to me when we bought the steak. shit, that's not on, is it? No one ate Belinda. Belinda ended up being a companion cow to a house cow. Because those are things that exist, apparently. Yeah, and lived to a happy, ripe old age at Lindy's farm. God, how long does it take for a cow to get from small to big? However long that was. Like, a year? God. We had it for a year. She was so beautiful.
Today we've got stories about pets, the love we feel for them and the terrible loss when they're gone. Later, we're going to have a look at the changing business of pet grief. But before we get to that, shockingly, it's estimated that nearly 20,000 family pets are surrendered to the RSPCA every year because landlords say no. That's the difficult reality behind renting with pets in New South Wales, where landlords can legally veto renters with animals. But it doesn't have to be this way. In our next story, we look at what it means when we're not allowed to live with our pets.
And you know what? I can tell you now, on my floor in my apartment, I wasn't the only person that had a secret pet. Like, I knew everybody on my floor that had a secret pet.
This is secret pet owner Bonnie.
I had been wanting a kitty for a little while now. And during the time when we had adopted, like, our senior cat, Vera, I had actually just been diagnosed with, like, Hashimoto's disease, which is, like, a thyroid illness. And what attracted me to this particular cat was that she also had a thyroid disease. And I was very sensitive at the time, and I was like, no, just because you have a thyroid disease doesn't mean no one will love you. And so I adopted this cat into our house, knowing full and well that we were not allowed to have a cat in our apartment. Maybe don't use my last name, by the way, just in case the landlord is listening.
At the moment in New South Wales, you have to declare pets, and your landlord can discriminate against you based on that. There are exceptions for assistant and service animals, like guide dogs, for visually impaired tenants, but people with regular companion animals, as they're called, they can have a hard time finding rental in New South Wales.
I have a lot to say about this, actually, because, you know, shelters are filled with animals that need homes, and there are people out there that desperately want pets, but they can't because their landlords are saying no.
By now, it's pretty much an accepted truth that New South Walers are increasingly tied to the rental market. So what's going to happen to pet culture? And what are New South Walers doing about it? The Tenants Union of Victoria says the health and well-being benefits of having a pet are well known. Mental health through companionship, physical health through regular exercise, adoption and raising of abandoned animals, keeping strays off the street, teaching kids responsibility, teaching kids about death and loss, animal friendship, a parenting opportunity for people who can't biologically have kids, the list goes on. And that's just off the top of my head.
When I let people know what breed she is, I always have to kind of insert a disclaimer that says she's a Chihuahua, but she's a nice one, because there's so much stigma around what Chihuahuas are like.
Laura is a 33-year-old writer and graphic designer living in Sydney. She's had her dog Susie for about 6 years.
She was one of five, and it was just, we just picked the one that had all the personality. She's definitely quite sassy. She's very, very sweet, a little bit neurotic, and she's got quite a funny sense of humour. So it's like she laughs, like she'll do something and she's kind of got this trot and this smile that says, haha, like, got you kind of thing. I'm thinking she's about to turn six, and I look at her and I'm always counting down how many more years we've got together.
Laura was living in Leichhardt in Sydney when she got Susie 6 years ago.
And I got approval from the landlord to get a really small dog, which is why I ended up with her. From there, we moved to Drummoyne, Woollahra, Paddington, Newtown, Erskineville, and now the Northern Beaches. So there's, you know, half a dozen or so properties together.
Over the years, Laura has mostly had approval to have Susie in her rental properties from lenient and understanding landlords. landlords who go against the trend and choose to allow pets. But during the search for her current place, she started encountering problems. At the first property where she was approved, the offer was retracted because the landlord found out that she had a dog.
And then in another instance, I had run the dog by the property manager who said, yep, that's all fine. And then we sat up all night putting together this really kind of extensive application that took hours and hours, followed up about it about a day or two later. And the property manager said, oh, sorry to waste your time, but the landlord's not actually going to look at the application because they don't want dogs. So after those two incidents, when we went for this place, I decided not to disclose that we had her.
Today, she lives in a two-bedroom unit in Freshwater with Susie.
So I've just kind of ran with the lie for nearly 12 months now.
The people we chatted to about secret pet ownership described it as a necessity. For many of these renters, hiding their animal from their landlord was seen as a short-term solution. Since the majority of leases in Sydney are 12 months or less, and the turnover is high as rental prices continue to soar. But even in a short-term lease, sneaking a pet in is risky business.
My landlord, a couple of months ago, I actually caught him snooping and looking in the window when he thought that I was at work, but I had actually just transitioned and started working from home. And I was on a phone meeting at the time in my pajamas, and he was looking in the window. And I just looked at him and I said, I'm in a meeting. And then he left and he was quite embarrassed. I called the property manager later and I said, that's not on. He's got no right to be on the property without making an appointment. And she was, you know, totally agreed with me. But the funny thing was, when he did that, my dog was actually sleeping under the window right underneath him. And it's really lucky that she didn't realise he was there, because it's a private pathway that not even tenants are meant to walk down. So occasionally when someone does, that's the only time that she will bark, because it's unusual. So I didn't care. If he was to find out that she was there from snooping, well, it's kind of like, well, what are you doing here in the first place? So
because of situations like Laura and Susie, groups like the Tenants Union are campaigning to make it legal for landlords to discriminate against pet owners. New South Wales Labor hasn't ruled out supporting them if they get in the next election. If they adopt the policy and the law is changed, New South Wales tenants may no longer have to declare pets. The question is, would this be fair to landlords?
Now, we know there's always two sides to every story. There's plenty of stories where landlords have treated tenants badly. Let's make no mistake about that. But the reality is, there's just as much on the flip side. And, you know, the pieces that we pick up as managing agents on properties, we see it. We see both sides of the story. And that's why we are firmly of the belief that there has to be a balanced approach in tenancy laws. There are two parties and it requires equality on both sides.
This is John Cunningham, CEO of the Real Estate Institute of New South Wales. They oppose changing the tenancy laws. In fact, their official position is pretty clear.
In our belief, anyone who wants a pet requires landlord's permission to have a pet. Yeah, that is an inalienable right that's existed through property ownership. And therefore, to say that anyone can have any pet at any time in any property is quite frankly ludicrous. Because, as I said, there are responsible pet owners and there are irresponsible pet owners. And the damage that pets can do to a property is extensive and has been proven to be extensive over time.
The Real Estate Institute's attitude is centred on risk. Not all pets are bad, but there's a risk. Landlords know any tenant carries a risk, and sometimes it can be easy to generalise as a method of weeding out risk. You might think toddlers are a risk with their finger painting. Or you might think footballers with their muddy boots are a risk as well. But the difference is you can't legally ask someone to tick a box declaring that they play field sports and then cull their application based on that. With pets, however, you can.
I think one of the issues that a lot of pet owners have is they think there's a right to do that rather than actually a right to earn the right to actually have that pet. So I think what people fail to do is actually to put forward a case that is convincing enough to actually have a pet. And that means pet references, videos of the pet. There's a lot of things that people can do to actually potentially placate an owner to say, well, actually, yeah, you are a responsible pet owner and I'm okay with that.
Not all landlords see it as their right to dictate whether tenants come with pets. In fact, some see accommodating companion animals as just a normal part of being a landlord.
Did you specify dog or cat? I can't remember.
I think we specified a pet with an application, so we would have final say. So obviously if they were moving in with a massive elephant, we'd probably say no. House not up to it.
I don't know what we'd say no to, though. Like, what pet would you say no to? Really?
Yeah.
I can't think of a pet we wouldn't allow.
You do have, as a landlord, you have bond, and you also generally will have landlord's insurance, which should cover any accidents or anything. Yeah. So,
Julia and her partner Mick are landlords who own a couple of properties and are generally fine with pets.
I think just blanket banning them's not the answer. It's more about working with them to ensure the animal's trained and, you know, suitable for that property size.
And I think the key is when you own a property that you're leasing to somebody, you change the rules a little bit as well, because that house is, you're not living there, someone else is living there, and you want to give people the opportunity to live comfortably and have a life that they want to have. We're not too precious, I guess, with the property either. Like, yeah, there's going to be wear and tear, and it just happens when you're a landlord. Things do get worn out.
Well, I think a child could quite easily damage your property, but you would never ban a child from your property. They're just as probably as uncontrollable as animals. So, you know, you want people to feel at home, and if it's an animal they love, well, they can live there with an animal.
For the Real Estate Institute of New South Wales, it's a pretty black and white situation.
I mean, it's a pretty black and white situation. We have some landlords who says, look, you know, I'm a great pet owner and I'm responsible, but I won't have that in my investment property. And that's their right to make that determination. So I think the existing laws are fair in that people have that opportunity, and there are properties that are leased out specifically that do allow pets. But it comes down to the person who has the pet putting forward a case that is compelling for them to have the pet.
After a long run of renting in Sydney, Laura and Susie are moving to Melbourne. It's likely they'll have a much easier time there, since pet declaration is not asked for. If the law ever changes in New South Wales, we might see Laura and Susie back again.
I think in the past I've been really quite scared of authority in the form of, say, a landlord or a real estate. But as I get older and as the property market in Sydney gets tougher, I just think I don't really care anymore. I know I'm a great tenant. I've got an immaculate record. The dog is so quiet. She's house trained. It's like having a really nice placid cat. So I don't care. And it just got to the point where I was like, if they find out, they're going to have a pretty big fight on their hands trying to evict me.
That story was by Selena Shannon, with voiceover by Tegan Nichols, an additional interview contribution from Eliza Burlidge, and help from Alison Chan. I can still so vividly remember the day my friend Sophie tipped my sea monkeys out, all over the floor, killing them all. Now, it might sound a bit ridiculous to grieve over sea monkeys, but I was devastated. And to this day, I still haven't spoken to her. Something happens when we bring an animal into our lives as a pet. We develop relationships with them. We get to know their personalities. They become an important part of us. And then we lose them. We're talking about pets today on All the Best. Our next story, by Britta Jorgensen, looks at how we all deal with pet loss differently, and sometimes in ways that others don't understand.
This is how I like to keep it really simple. Like that. And I have another thing at home that sits on there. So I wrap the body up and then it goes in this bag. I've got all different sizes. Yeah, and then the body just goes there.
It's just a dead body, so like, what do you do with it? And I like put him outside on the veranda, and it was like winter, so it was freezing out there. Like, all I could think of was, like, I need to bring him in and warm him up. And it was really weird.
I went back to working. And once again, I was working a split shift. So I got a small break, like a 45-minute break, where I got to go home and dig a hole and bury him with his favourite shirt in their backyard under the apple tree. And then just have to go back to work.
So what happens at the actual funeral ceremony?
I'm very connected to ritual, so I have a very ritualistic way of doing it. So I have a cloth that I place down. I make a little altar. I have flowers, any letters that they've written, I read out. I light a candle. Quite often, when I get to a house, there's already an altar being made. They're already doing it. It's a natural thing. Sometimes I've seen things, I'm like, whoa, the TV, huge screen, has montage going all day and candles all around the room and, yeah. It helps people heal. It's the beginning of the morning. And it doesn't fix everything, but it really does help the grieving process. Yeah.
Can I have a look at the back?
Yeah, sure.
While I remember, can I just get you to just introduce yourself, just say your name and what you do?
Yeah. My name is Caroline Higgins, and I'm the funeral director for Pause and Reflect Pet Funerals.
There was one kind of moment where he like just forgot he was sick or something. Do you remember this? And we were standing in the kitchen and he just kind of like ran around smelling things, just forgetting that he couldn't eat, and it wasn't very long, like less than a minute or something, he was running around. And it was like so sad because we knew that he probably wasn't getting better.
Sorry.
Oh, hey.
I'm Zoe.
Hi.
Oh, it's been one of those mornings, and now we've just looked at one of our other patients and done some x-rays and like, oh, yay, you need a surgery.
When these guys get sick, they get sick dramatically, and everything is kind of much more rushed. You have to kind of do things really quickly. So it does mean that, you know, we kind of stretch out the time that we spend with clients and patients because we need to look a little bit deeper, because we can't just play wait and see as much as in dogs and cats.
My name's Zoe and I am a vet at Melbourne Rabbit Clinic, so I deal just with rabbits and guinea pigs.
Do you have any like kind of particularly memorable stories of patients that you've...
I have so many. We've got, you know, a couple of families of guinea pigs who are, you know, medically drama children, but we absolutely love them, and they're all complicated little personalities in themselves. Guinea pigs are very individualistic. They always have really dramatic hair, so they come in and you're like, oh, you've got such cool hair and you've got such a cool little personality and like jaunty little things, and they'll shout at you when you do anything, like, how dare you touch my feet. This is very much my dream job and what I wanted to do since I was like 7 years old. And when I was little, my family got a bunny and he became very sick when, you know, I was about 6 or 7, and he needed a lot of medical care and stuff like that. And my family just kind of, this was way back in the early 90s, and my family was just like, that's completely fine. We'll pay thousands of dollars for surgeries for this bunny and medical care for this bunny. And a lot of the time, even now, when you turn around and you go, you know, my rabbit or my guinea pig needs this much money's worth of medical care, they're like, but it's only a small animal, why are you doing this, and all of that sort of stuff. So for me, I'm not particularly surprised because that was just kind of the norm with me growing up. And it is kind of nice to work in a clinic where a lot of our clients come here because they have the same sort of values about their pets and they believe them to be, you know, just as deserving of extensive medical care if they needed as a dog or a cat would be. So it's an evolving sort of vet landscape.
Because I remember when the vet was like, you know, we can just put him down because that would be cheaper. It was going to be like quite a lot of money to have this surgery. We didn't really have that money, but it wasn't really a question of whether we were going to do it or not. We were going to do anything to try and save him.
cost of the surgery was nothing compared to the cost of his life, really. It'd be horrifying to think you wouldn't do that.
Shitoto.
It was like he was kind of part of our little team, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was you, me, and Toto.
We're still kind of moving into this world where people do pay a little bit more attention to their small animals and they are willing to go the extra mile and stuff like that.
The vet called and said he couldn't find anything and he would just stay there trying to recover from the anaesthetic. And then I think, yeah, we went and picked him up. He was just, like, not waking up really at all.
Yeah, it's very, very sad. Sitting on the couch with you and Toto.
I think we put him next to our bed for that night and I just kept waking up and hoping that he would be like a little tiny bit more awake, and he wasn't. And yeah, in the morning we just decided we would have to take him in to be put down.
Yeah, anthropomorphism is always something that we worry about in the vet world, just because sometimes it can make life more difficult in terms of medical care and stuff like that, and also just assuming that they process things the same way as we do and stuff like that. So it's definitely that something that vets have to kind of be cautious about. I mean, it definitely does make life difficult if you've got bad news to deliver to people when their bunnies are super close to them or their piggies are super close to them and they have to kind of process that sort of complicated news.
It's a very sensitive relationship people have with their animals because people believe the pet understands them intrinsically and 100%. More than a human. And they, even though the pet can't talk, they can relate on other levels. So they give the animal superpowers, really.
We took him in that little shirt that he loved to hide underneath. And so they took him off and put him to sleep. And, yeah, it was pretty quick. And I just remember, like, taking him, putting him back in the car and driving back, like it all happened really quickly. And I was just like, do I talk to him? He's not there anymore. It was really hard and really weird because I did know that he was dead. But just part of me just like, I guess just couldn't really believe it or just couldn't, yeah, combine those two facts.
The only reason I was working so much at the time was because one of my workmates, mum's had just died, so she had to take the time off, and so we were incredibly understaffed. I felt like I would just be a bit, I don't know, I'd just be a bit silly to ask to have the day off because my little guinea pig had died. So I worked on through that day, and it was like a busy Friday night, and I remember one of my workmates was like, oh, so how's your guinea pig, John? Because I suppose he was trying to make small talk. And I was like, oh, well, he died today. And I had to bury him before. And he was like, oh, I felt really bad. But I was like, no, it's like, it was sweet of you to ask. But just, yeah.
I could shock you. Even last week, I had what I considered a very tough guy, really tough, really big, with this tiny little dog. I think it weighed under 2 kilos, but he had this dog for 15 years, and he was holding it together for a moment, and then not. And it was like he was ashamed to grieve for his pet. I basically, by me agreeing with him, gave him license to be emotional. But as soon as one of his friends came over, he stopped, you know? So because I'm in this field, they feel comfortable to be upset, particularly men. And another man just sobbed, telling me he can't work out why he's so attached to this cat. It's never happened to him before in his life. And he was middle-aged. He said he doesn't know why. He said, I think something's wrong with me. You know, like, they just don't understand.
And then the house was pretty empty after that.
No, well, yeah, there was the occasional stray poo would show up every now and then.
I remember being really sad about it for so long. I don't think either of us expected to be quite so upset about it all.
It must have had such a large presence in our household for such a small little thing.
I don't know exactly why, but some people just go, are you serious? People actually have pet funerals? And I go, yeah. They don't get it. They just don't get it. So I don't know why they don't get it. Could be they've never experienced it. It's helping people get through that maze of attachment that they've created with their pet. We're not just disposing of the body or anything like that. So they're not just put in a plastic bag. So really it's to make people feel better, because it's so, well, yeah, I've heard it all. There's people, they may never get over it. But others, I find, once they see me do it, look after their pet, they feel better.
That story was by Britta Jorgensen, with help from supervising producer Selena Shannon. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager. Tegan Nichols compiles our show, and I'm Jess Hamilton. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton, and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're at it, subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app.